Well, I know people come into other countries and they say, oh, I love your country and all this stuff. We get that sometimes. I love your country, England. It's so quaint and so small and all this stuff. But I can honestly say that I can't remember ever coming into a country and feeling at home so fast. I remember coming in on the plane into Zagreb Airport and seeing the countryside, and it looked beautiful. And from the moment I landed, I've just met friendly people. But the thing that's and shocked me in the last 2.5 days is the number of people that are aware of my information here, and the how informed people are. You know, when I did, for instance, a web chat, the questions were coming in were detailed questions about stuff that's in my books. And you know, you don't usually get that, and I've been really taken aback. And when I've been interviewed on television, you know, normally you get the question is, you know, how long have you been insane and all this stuff. And yet on Croatian television, I've been treated with respect, the information's been treated with respect, and people, quite rightly, the viewers, have been allowed just to make of it what they will. And it's been like a dream for me, because I'm not used to it. I'm used to the opposite from mainstream media, not least in Britain, where they've been attacking me now for nearly 20 years. So I love it here, and I love the people that I've met, and I don't think I've had so many intelligent conversations with so many people in such a short time, for a long, long time. So. When people said to me yesterday, would you like to come back? I mean, crikey, are you kidding? Anytime, yeah. Well, this is such an important area, because I can speak from experience, having been in Britain since we joined the European Union, or the European Community as it was. And Croatia now is facing a major choice. It's allowing its government to take an independence, one at great cost in conflict and upheaval, and handing it to a network of dark-suited, dark-minded bureaucrats in Brussels, or saying, this independence was too hard won and is too important for us to allow a government here today, gone tomorrow, to give this away. The European Union is sold as almost like a protective cloak. You must come into our protection. Well, I remember having a long conversation with a friend of mine in Africa. He's a Zulu shaman and the official historian of the Zulu nation. And if a technique works, then just keep using it. And he was telling me that when the British, particularly the British, went into Africa, there weren't anything like as many colonial invaders, if you like. Nothing like a fraction of the people they wanted to take over. So what they did, particularly through a guy called Cecil Rhodes, who was an infamous frontman for this network of families that I'm exposing, he would go to a tribal chief, and he would spread rumor and fear that another tribe was preparing to attack them. And he would do the same to the other tribal chief. And he would bring these tribal groups into conflict, into a war. And then when they were on the brink of destroying each other, he would go into both of them and say, look, the only way, or sometimes one of them, if one had already, you know, been destroyed, or was on the brink of being destroyed, and he would say, look, the only way that you're going to survive in the situation you're now in is to come, here we go, under the protection of the British Empire. And that protection of the British Empire meant the British authorities taking control of the land, taking control of the people, taking control of the laws imposed upon the people, And in this way, step by step, conflict by conflict, protection by protection, a few people took over the whole of southern Africa, and indeed the whole of Africa in the end, by different other European colonial powers. Now, what's happening with the European Union is that they're now doing the same without using open conflict, by economic fears and other fears of how can a small nation survive outside of the big web of the European Union, to get countries to believe that really they've got no choice but to come under that protection. It's not true. And it's not about protection, it's about control. I've been writing for years about the structure that allows a few to control the many globally. And the idea is to create a world government which would dictate to every country, a world army that would impose the will of the world government on countries that wanted to resist, a world currency, a world central bank, a microchip population. And under that, they want the European Union, the American Union, which is being manipulated rapidly in the background, the Asia-Pacific Union, and the African Union, which already have. There's probably a Middle East Union in there to come as well. And under that edifice of power would come what we now call nation states, who would have no power over their destiny. For instance, in Britain today, a country of 60 million people, not 4.5 million, our laws are almost entirely controlled, and our even the fine detail of people's lives are controlled by laws imposed by bureaucrats in Brussels. A British politician estimated recently that we've reached the point where 70 to 75% of the laws imposed on Britain every year actually originate with the European Union bureaucracy. The moment Croatia signs into Europe, they will become subject to that scale of imposition. And that scale as it is now, because that's not where they want to go, where they are, they still want to move forward to more and more control. And having the conflict in this area of the world, which broke up the former Yugoslavia into its constituent parts, they're now in a process of picking off those constituent parts into the European web, Croatia is the next in line. And if the Croatian people realize what's waiting for them, they would resist vigorously the government's designs to sell, not even sell, give away their independence and their sense of history, community, uniqueness to these bureaucrats. And from the moment it happens, there will be an explosion of diktats, of laws, of regulations that will change the face of this country. And I know that's a fact because it's done that to Britain. Whenever I look into the backgrounds of conflicts, it's invariably a different story to the one that was officially given to the people. And invariably, the people that come in towards the end as the saviors are actually the people that manipulated the thing in the first place. And who come in as the savior? British and Americans, again. And Milosevic, for instance, was a blue-eyed boy of the Americans at one point. And what they do is they put people into power, and they give the impression that a country that they've placed the leader in is controlling its own destiny, when in the background they're controlling. But these leaders are not just puppets, they are completely expendable. So while Milosevic was doing what was required, which was to trigger the conflict and what came out. Soon as he becomes surplus to requirements, or it becomes more effective for the agenda to target him, they'll target him. I'll give you a wonderful example of what I'm talking about. Saddam Hussein was put into power in Iraq by a CIA manipulated coup, and he was such a again, a blue-eyed boy frontman for America, that in 1983, and there's pictures of this as well as documentation through State Department documents, Donald Rumsfeld, who was then not officially in politics, was dispatched to Baghdad by the Reagan-Bush administration in the in 1983 to arrange for the shipment of biological and chemical weapons to Saddam Hussein to use against the Iranians in the Iraq-Iranian war. And then they would say later that Saddam is a monster because he used chemical weapons against the Kurds, when yes, he did, and they were your chemical weapons that you gave him. They don't mention that bit. And for a long time, Saddam served the agenda. But then it became more useful, as the agenda unfolded, to actually turn him into a monster. And he was the blue-eyed boy, yes, and America supported him. But he was a pawn in the game. And so now it's time to turn against him because it suits us. And they justified two wars in the Gulf War in 1991, wasn't it, and the invasion of Iraq in 2003 on the basis of Saddam, their former frontman, being a monster. So you put someone in, he does what he does, and then those who've put him in come round at the end as the saviors and take over control. And the people think don't realize that the people behind the man are the people that came to remove the man later in the story. And we've got the topical situation now with Georgia. Georgia, again, like Milosevic and other similar countries, was supposed to be an independent state that had its own democracy, or that chose its own leader. Well, the truth is that the so-called Rose Revolution, which was promoted as a people's revolution, a people's rebellion in Georgia, to remove the previous regime of Shevardnadze, was funded and manipulated by especially an infamous American financier called George Soros. This has now been well documented. Soros has these endless web of funds and charities, stuff like that. But they're not charities, they are fronts for his manipulation. And what he did in Georgia was fund large numbers of students to be trained in the art of civil disobedience, and which they then put into practice to bring down the regime. And one of the key people at the forefront of all this was an American-trained lawyer and a associate, you might call it, of a man called Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor and is now the key man behind Barack Obama. And so what the Americans were doing in Georgia was funding and manipulating the revolution, letting it play out as if it was a people's spontaneous rebellion, and ending up putting their person on the top as president. So when you look at what has happened in recent times, this guy, Saakashvili, would not go to the toilet without permission from the American authorities, because he completely has been put there by them and depends for his survival on them. So when he struck against South Ossetia, he was officially the man behind it, but the Americans would have been behind that. And I've seen reports and articles about this where people have said that how stupid that that should happen. I mean, everyone knew the Russians would respond, but we can get manipulated by thinking that a decision to do something is stupid because we don't know the outcome that they're looking for. And if we knew the outcome they're looking for, then what seems to be stupid takes on a very different light. Of course the Americans behind the Georgian president knew what the Russian response was going to be, and it's the response they were looking for, because they're seeking to constantly keep the world, not least that area around the Caspian Sea, in a state of conflict. This is what they're doing in the Middle East. They want it in a state of conflict, because it's very difficult to manipulate a state of harmony where everyone's getting on and everyone's in harmony with each other and supportive and respectful of each other. It's a very difficult situation to manipulate that. Manipulation is much easier when you're in a state of conflict where and hostility. Because like Cecil Rhodes in Africa, you can go to a tribal chief and play one against the other and the other one against the other, and you can use the turmoil and the hostility to bring about the outcome that you want. And one of the elements of where they want to take the world is a third world war, which they wish to involve Europe, the United States, and, well, Canada, North America, and Russia and China. I was told by insiders in the 1990s about in America that the plan was to lead to a conflict involving China. For this reason, in the 1800s, letters were written, and particularly one particular letter between two high-level players in the secret society network, in which the three world wars were described of where they were going to go. And this letter included the detail of countries that would be involved and how it would be started. And it described the First World War, with the Germans brought into conflict with the rest of Europe and America. It described the Second World War in the same terms and said it would lead to a Jewish state in Israel. And the Third World War would be triggered out of the Middle East, involving Israel as the trigger, and would bring about the final global conflict, which would lead to them being able to offer the solution to stop this ever happening again, which would be a world government and a single world army. And the idea of that is to say, if we have a single world army and we bring an end to national armies, then we can't ever again have a war. What they won't tell you is those that have manipulated the war will be the same people that offer the solution to the war, which is exactly the structure of control that they want. And I feel very strongly that Georgia, I'm not saying this war's going to happen tomorrow, but Georgia was a move on the chessboard in this direction. And I'll tell you a story that happened to me in England which relates to this. And it seems, you know, quite a minor story until it starts to play out. Last March 2008, I received a letter from a man in England who is called there, a traffic warden. And his job, they walk along the streets in a uniform, and they give out tickets to cars for illegal parking or whatever. You know, not many people like them for that reason, but they just do that job. And this traffic warden, he'd been a traffic warden for nearly 20 years, he wrote to me because he read my books, and he said, look, there's something I don't understand, and there's something that's really bewildering me. He said, I've been called in by my boss, and I, like my colleagues, he said, I've been given three cards, authorization cards. He said, one of the cards is to give me authorization to be a traffic warden. Okay. But the second card was what they call in Britain a pace card, and that carries the words that policemen have to say by law when they're arresting somebody. And the third card was the authorization of this man and his colleagues, traffic wardens, to go into private property without permission. So this man, who's a nice guy, he said to his boss, why do I need the statement you make to arrest people if you're a policeman, and why do I need authorization to go into private property? And his boss said, look, I'd be told to give them out, take them home, leave them until further notice. A few days later, him and a few other traffic wardens are outside the police station in this county, this town. And a policeman came out that this traffic warden had known a long time, hadn't seen for a while. And the policeman came over and made the small talk, and then he pulled his friend aside. He said, I want to talk to you. And he said to him four or five times in this conversation, you must not breathe a word about this. He said, I've got the job, he said, in this county, and there's someone like me in every other county of the United Kingdom, policeman, whose job it is to organize in preparation for a coming war. He said, we're preparing for this war well in advance. And he said, what's expected by the government is that when this war starts, there will be massive civil unrest on the streets of Britain and protest. He said, so what's happening is that when that war starts and the protests start and the civil unrest they're expecting, the military and ourselves, police officers, will be focusing on dealing with the civil unrest. And you, traffic wardens, private security guards and companies, closed circuit television operators and all these kind of people will be brought forward to do the jobs that police officers currently do while we're dealing with the civil unrest. Well, he sent me the cards and I saw them to confirm they existed. A few days after he contacted me, the British government announced that they were going to redesignate and rename traffic wardens civil enforcement officers, and they were going to give them powers, some of the powers currently that the police have. 10 days ago, all these months later after this happened, 10 days ago, the government in Britain announced that they were introducing a new designation of authority called accredited persons. And these were security guards, private security firms, CCTV operators, etc., who were going to be given accredited person status and given powers that are currently the powers of the police. Now, why I tell this story is that everything that this police officer said was going to happen is happening or has happened. The only thing that remains is the war. And that fits with all these other different pieces of information that suggests that a major conflict is being orchestrated, which is designed to change the face of society. Because there's nothing that changes society faster than a war. And this has been going on way back. One of the examples that I put in my books is this: the First World War in relation to America. In the 1950s, there was an investigation by a congressional committee called the Rees Committee into what are known in America as tax-exempt foundations. These are organizations funded by the Rockefellers and the major elite families, who then pass the money out in apparently charitable ways, but it's nothing to do with charity. It's to do with funding this agenda while appearing not to be. And one of these organizations that they investigated, and there was a guy called Norman Dodds who was the main investigator, was an organization which is still going in America called the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. What these investigators found was that this Endowment for International Peace was manipulating war. And they found minutes of meetings of this organization from the period in the early part of the 20th century in which they were having meetings and discussions and saying, we need to change the face of American society and society in general. What's the most effective way of doing that? Well, it's a war. So we need to get America involved in a war. And Woodrow Wilson was the president of America at the time. And it's actually in the minutes of this organization that they sent messages to Woodrow Wilson telling him not only to he must get involved in this war in Europe, but that he must stay in it for as long as it takes for American society to change in a way that's never going to change back again. And if you look at the world after a war, it's never the same as it was before, especially world wars. And they want this third world war to change the face of global society to the point where they can introduce this centralized global structure. As they used to say in the 1960s with the Vietnam War, what would happen if we had a war and no one turned up? There'd be no war. What these people do is they declare wars and they get the rest of us to fight them. What we've got to do is stop fighting them and stop falling for this scam. Because if we do, if we go into this third world war, then, you know, goodbye freedom. I completely agree with that. The more I'm feeling a sense of panic to push this on as fast as possible. I think in the time scale that they ideally wanted, they would invaded Iran quite a time ago, but they've just not been able to orchestrate the excuse and to get the people to give it any support. And so they've not been able to do it. And I think in terms of that, they're behind the time scale. And they are in a panic. And it's very clear that two things are happening side by side. One is this desire to push on with this Orwellian state, more and more control, more and more centralization of power. Where at the same time, and it's become so tangible to me, and I can see the difference because when I started 20 years ago, it wasn't there. That people are beginning to awaken to see the game in a way that they haven't seen it before. And the more that people awaken to be able to see it and say, hold on, something's happening here that I didn't realize before, the greater the panic is to try to put the lid on. And the thing they want more than anything else is a microchip population. I met a scientist in America in 1997 who worked for the CIA, and he asked to see me to tell me what he knew was going on, and he couldn't because he couldn't speak publicly about it. And he told me the story that he joined the CIA thinking he was serving his country, because the way they compartmentalized knowledge, most of the people working for these organizations are not trying to manipulate anybody, but they're being manipulated themselves to push the world in a certain direction. They don't even know they're doing it. And he said that when he got into the CIA, and he was an expert in the area of magnetics, he realized that this agenda that I've been writing about was going on. He hadn't read my stuff before, but he saw from the inside what the game was, and then read my stuff and realized that what I was saying matched what he was experiencing. So he arranged this meeting through a third party. And I said to him, first of all, why do you do it if you're so against it? And he opened his shirt. And on his shirt was this like see-through shampoo sachet. And inside was like an orangey golden liquid, and it was stuck to his chest. He said, this is why. He said that when he realized what he was being used for and what he was being asked to do, he rebelled and refused to do it. And then at that time, he remembers leaving his house and he remembers nothing else. The next thing he remembers is waking up in a room on a table type bed bench that he's seeing like a doctor's office. And as he woke up and got his mind back, he felt something on his chest, and when he looked, there was this thing. And they call these things in the CIA patches. Someone's been patched. And what it is, they manipulate these people to need this drug to survive, and if the drug is then not replaced, they start to die a very agonizing death. And he knows that because even after he was patched, he rebelled again, and they didn't repatch him, and he felt the consequences until they put the patch back, when he agreed, okay, I'll work for you. And these patches have to be replaced every 72 hours. And if he doesn't use his genius, and he told me that there are enormous numbers of scientists in the underground secret projects and bases in America, and I guess worldwide, who are patched for this reason. If they don't use their genius and knowledge to advance the agenda, then they're not patched, repatched, and they die. And this is how they orchestrate it. Now, the reason I tell you this story is about microchips is because this scientist said to me, this man, first of all, the cure for cancer is well known. He said, I got cancer, and they wanted to keep me alive for obvious reasons so I could continue my work for them. He said, and they gave me a serum, as he called it. He was injected with this serum, cancer disappeared. Secondly, they have the technology, which he helped to develop, which would create abundant growth in deserts without water. What they do, every living thing, including humans, obviously, have an electromagnetic field. We call it the auric field. And if you stimulate this field in a certain way, he said the plants grow so fast, it's like a time-lapse photograph, watching it sometimes. And the third thing he said is that if people say no to just one thing in this whole agenda, say no to the microchip. Because he told me many things which have proved to be correct. First of all, in 1997, he said, people think of microchips like that. He said, outside the public arena, he said, they are so small, they can be inserted by a hypodermic needle in a vaccination program. And people in those days weren't talking about nanotechnology, but now we can see that that's true. The other thing he said was, even those that are looking at the microchip and seeing that, hey, there's a conspiracy here, they're thinking only in terms of electronic tagging, just so the computer knows where everyone is. And on one level, that's true. But he said the real reason for the microchips is, just as you have now this movement towards what they call human-computer interface, where the human brain can work a computer without touching any keys, they can do that because the human body is, in fact, a very, very staggeringly advanced computer. And so when they're dealing with computer human interface, they're actually connecting two computers, one extraordinarily more advanced and complex than the other, obviously. So he said that when they get a microchip inside you, basically they're chipping a computer in the sense that they're operating. And therefore, they can manipulate the computer electrically, electromagnetically, and chemically from a distance, to manipulate people mentally, emotionally, and physically. So once you get one of these chips inside you, they can take you out from a distance. They can destabilize your body so you get illnesses which take you out or make your life more difficult. They can manipulate you emotionally so that you become aggressive or docile and subservient. And they can manipulate your thoughts. So, because on one level, of course, when you have a thought, it's an electrical sequence that happens. thought waves, electrical pulses. If you said if they can get into your brain at that electrical level, they can put thoughts into your mind, which you are having, that you think are your own thoughts, when in fact they're being externally implanted through the chip. In fact, I read a lot of material in the 90s about Russian experiments, or Soviet experiments as they were, during the Cold War, about their experiments in external manipulation of the mind through technology. And they were doing things. I remember one example that was in one of these documents. They would fire thought waves at gardeners who were working in these big kind of mansion country places that this research was going on. And they would fire thought waves which said things like, put down your tools and go in and have a cup of tea. And they would watch and they would wait. And within less than a minute, these people were having a discussion, putting their tools down and walking in to have a cup of tea. And those people, they were working on the garden, and they thought, I'll tell you what, guys, let's go and have a cup of tea. Let's have a break. And this is what they can do, because they understand the computer nature of the physical body and how you can access it. And the chip is the jewel in the crown of this whole thing. Because as this scientist said, if you say no to just one thing, say no to the chip. Because once you've done that, they have external access to your body systems. And what they're doing is now introducing chipping around the world for various ways. That they got people used to it by chipping domestic animals. So then it becomes part of society, chipping. There are, they're talking about in Britain chipping prisoners so that they can let them out of jail. There's Mexican officials in the government who are chipped so that if they're abducted, that they can be found. They're now saying to parents, if your children were microchipped, you'd always know where they were. They could always be found. And all these different excuses that are being used. And it's a cover for this control that this scientist told me about over 10 years ago. Well, you see, they're talking in Britain of introducing identity cards, and I keep saying to people, no, that's not the end, that's the stepping stone. Again, you know, the greatest technique of manipulation is this one that I call problem, reaction, solution. Create the problem, offer the solution, which is the solution that advances your agenda. And what we've got in Britain, we had credit cards, and you used to sign for your credit card. And then they said, well, you know, there's a lot of fraud and stuff, and so what we're going to do is we're going to have something called chip and PIN. And what this is the card is chipped, and now you put your credit card in a machine, and you put your PIN number in. But now they're saying, well, I'm sorry, even that's, there's lots of fraud, even with chip and PIN. Well, what can we do to stop fraud so people can't steal our cards? What if you had something just under the skin? They couldn't get it then, could they? Oh, no. And here we go. And it's so blatant when you've got the coordinates and you can see the game. The other part of this is creating the cashless society. I've been writing about this now for nearly 20 years. This is a big one. I mean, in supermarkets now, they are replacing more and more in Britain people sitting there and taking your money with machines where you pay yourself by putting the things across the laser barcode reader, then putting your card in and paying yourself. Now, what you can't do with those machines is you can't pay cash. You have to have a card. And more and more of these rows of human people taking your money are being replaced. Why? Because The idea is total control through this means. At the moment, if you give someone a credit card and they put it in their machine and the machine won't accept it, then you still have the alternative of paying cash to purchase and function. Once they've taken cash out of circulation, and the cashless society, we're hurtling towards it, then when the machine says no, whoever programs that machine controls if you purchase or not. That's the idea. And this is why I spend so much time talking about these basic coordinates of where they're taking us and the methods they're using to take us there, because once you have them, you can read the world in a completely different way. Once you see the excuse, oh, you know, microchip your children, some of that, oh, we need the cashless societies, you won't have credit card fraud, you could see, okay, I can see that's what you're really after. But you have to have the coordinates to see that. And the idea is to keep that from us, which is why the world is promoted as being a series of unconnected incidents, people, organizations, and decisions, when actually at the core, these are all connected to push us in a certain direction. I work on the basis that I use to the best of my ability, in the most positive and effective way, what is available for me to use. But while I'm doing that, I'm totally aware that the system I'm using is totally corrupt and controlled. The internet is a big two-edged sword. On one side, because of course without military technology being allowed to be used originally, there'd be no internet. So for that, for the internet to be not only created but to be promoted on the scale it is, there is some big benefit for those behind it. And the benefit is, of course, surveillance is very, very easy. Reading people's emails, piece of cake. Reading and following where people go on the web in terms of websites gives you a good understanding of the character and profile of the person involved. You can also follow where they're going and who they're connecting with. So that's a very good thing. The negative side, from their point of view, is that it's allowed information to circulate, not least information like my own and other people like me, on a scale that we would never ever have got this information out on the scale we have without the internet in the time we have. So what they're trying to do now is keep the best part of it from their point of view and try to put the genie back in the bottle in terms of the communication of this information. And so they are getting closer and closer to introducing changes to the net which would make it more difficult to access websites like mine and such like, to suppress as much as possible the circulation of information they don't want people to see. For instance, you can go into airports in Britain and try to get davidicke.com. It won't come up. It's blocked. And then the same people in Britain are saying it's terrible in China. They edit the censor of the internet. Well, yeah, like you. You go into government departments or schools or whatever, you can't get these websites coming up. And ironically, someone went to the authorities at one point that were blocking it and said, why are you blocking davidicke.com at this airport? Oh, it's a pornographic site. Comes under pornography? What are you talking about? But it's just a way of logging it in so it's not accessed. But my feeling is that the genie is out of the bottle now, and it ain't going back. They're not going to be able to put it back. They'll try, but this information now has got a life of its own, and if they start clearly, blatantly blocking these websites, on a wider sense, all they're going to do is more and more give credibility to the websites and the information they carry. They're not going to put the genie back in the bottle. And it's funny that in the more recent times, I'm more optimistic about the way the world's going than I've been since I started this whole journey of discovery. Because for a long time, it looked really bleak and dark. And on one level, it still does, because this thing is moving on very fast on this control. But there is this tangible awakening of people in a way that they're seeing things they couldn't see before. And it's a curve that's starting to go up, straight up. And it's not just happening in Croatia. It's not just happening in Britain or America. It's happening everywhere. And the next few years are going to be very, very interesting, because we're going to see this rapidly gathering awakening of more people looking into the eyes of this rapidly escalating control. And it's going to be very interesting to see this unfold. And I'm very optimistic that, because the control relies almost entirely on the population enslaving each other, that although it seems a real powerful structure, in fact it's a house of cards. And it's a house of cards that we, the people, are holding up. And as people become more aware and see the game, then they're going to say, I'm not holding this up anymore. And the whole thing collapses. So, I've gone from being pretty kind of, oh my God, what are we going to do about this, to, I can see a way out of here now. And it's happened very quickly. And I've been talking to people in the recent few weeks who have the ability to put my information in front of significant people in at levels of the pyramid that we would perceive from the public perspective to be very high, when actually they're not, because the shadow people are, that you can't see, fill the top of the pyramid. But they're people who are important to making this agenda happen, but they don't know the significance of what they're doing. And if you can get to those people and they then start to see, hold on a second, I can see why I'm being asked to do this now, because then the pyramid starts to fall, because those vital levels of it, because there's of the people in full awareness of the manipulation and where they're going, incredibly few, globally incredibly few compared with the population, that they need these people at these levels of the pyramids in positions of, from a public point of view, like I say, significant authority and power to introduce and make the agenda happen without realizing the implications of what they're doing and even the origin of where this whole thing's coming from. And if you can get to them, then the whole power structure starts to fall, because they're vital to the power structure implementing what it wishes to do. And I think in the next 2 years, it's going to be some fantastic things happen. And there's going to be people at levels of authority who are going to openly be speaking out about this, and are going to be joining this movement to expose what's happening. I think I'm very, very optimistic about it now, for the first time since I started. The reason I say this is I remember what it was like 20 years ago, and I see what it's like now in terms of interest and what have you around the world. And it is staggeringly more advanced than it was when I started out. Is it the majority yet? Nothing like. But things can change very, very quickly once people are A, in receipt of certain information, but more than that, when they can see the information and they've reached a point where they can see it happening in their lives. And one of the reasons that, for instance, in England, in Britain, there's been an explosion of interest in my work when they ridiculed me mercilessly for 15 years or more, is because the changes in Britain that are being introduced are now allowing people to see that this A is no theory, and it's not even some forward projection anymore, certainly not in England. It's here. And as people go through this process, they don't half concentrate the mind and they start to look at what they wouldn't look at before. And I said years ago that the crucial time is going to be when that which has been manipulated behind the under the surface has to break into the public arena if it's going to bring the hidden manipulation into changes in society. And we're now at that point where it's breaking cover, as it has to you see, you can manipulate a world government here, or you can manipulate a world army, or you can manipulate closer and closer to a microchip population. But there comes a point where that has to break the surface and you start having to introduce microchips, talk about a world government, talk about a world army and all this stuff. And we're at the point now where so many of these hidden agendas are breaking the surface, and it's a period now of the next few years where we have a great opportunity to make a vast difference, because people will not be able to ignore, on the numbers that they have so far, what is actually their daily experience. And I'd like to, maybe we could meet 4 or 5 years from now. We live in a very different world. I would make the difference between prayer, which is what? Concentrated thought, and worship. It's a very true understanding that people have that work and experiment with energy and the mind, that when you focus on something, whatever it is, you focus your attention on it, you make an energetic connection. And worship is a real focused connection. It's a real focused connection to that which you're worshipping. And because of the way energy works, if you have a symbol, which people might call a deity in a religion, if that is actually a symbol of something else, say an entity, when you focus your worship on that deity, be it Jesus or Allah or any of them, Yahweh, you are focusing attention and you're focusing energy. You are making an energetic connection, which that entity can feed off your energy field. And I met a man who was one of these inventors of technology, very advanced stuff, in Utah. And he'd invented this technology which worked with the etheric energy field just outside of human sight. I mean, people, you know, even science understands that there's something there that we call the etheric field. Anyway, he said the only time that this technology didn't work efficiently was when the Mormon churches in the valley, and there was a lot of churches in his valley, were actually doing their worship ritual, because the etheric field was being filled by this energy of worship. So the more that I've understood this, it seems to me, not, and another level of this is all these different religions, when you break them down and take them back, are all based on sun and moon worship, sun god and moon goddess worship. These different religions are all excuses to get different groups to focus their attention and worship on the same entities. And the new age, where it focuses on Ashtar Command or the Great White Brotherhood or their version of Jesus and all this stuff, are these entities. They're also just another expression of this whole energy vampiring through worship. But that's different to prayer, which is concentrated thought. And I've kind of found in my life anyway that one of the most powerful energies to change our lives is intent. And if you put your intent out of what you want to do, what tends to happen is that energy will draw to you what you need to experience to achieve that intent. And this is where a lot of it falls down, because say you say, I want to expand my consciousness, I want to be the full potential of who I am, I want to know what this reality is, I want to know the big questions. When you put out that intent, you will draw to you in experience, people, information, that which will allow you to move into that desired intent. However, this will not be always people and experiences that you'd like to experience, because what's keeping us from that expanded consciousness is programmed beliefs and programmed thought patterns. And therefore, if we're going to achieve that intent that we want, these have to go. And so I can see this in my own life so clearly, and I see it in other people all the time. Once you put out that intent, I want to expand my consciousness, all the stuff I talked about, what you tend to start drawing towards you are people, experiences, and situations which you really would rather not like to experience. But what it does is it breaks down the programming because of the experiences it gives you, and you then start to break free. Say, for instance, one of your programs is fear of not having money. So you're focused on money all the time because you fear not having enough. If you want to be truly free, then that fear, that program has to go. So what someone like that would experience when they put out the intent is experiences would come towards them that would take the money away. And it's like, face your fear and realize there's nothing to be frightened about. People get confused then, and they think, oh, look, you know, I always want to be spiritual and good and stuff, and all hell's broken loose in my life, and it's terrible, I'm not doing this anymore. They don't realize what's happening. It took me a while to understand, because when I started on this journey, my life fell apart in the most extraordinary way. Everything that I saw as my security and sense of self, all of them went. But in doing so, it set me free. So the power of prayer is the power of intent in so many ways. And so what people call the power of prayer can be very, very powerful and very, very effective, so long as it's not done in worship, not done in subservience, but done in the understanding that we have the power to use our minds to make changes in our lives. And that's what prayer is, but religion has hijacked it and taken it off on another direction. I have to pray to a deity because I'm subordinate to the deity, and only the deity has control over my life, and please, deity, will you help me, because you're big and wonderful, I'm just little and small. Nonsense. That's how they control us.